Thank you. Be seated. Justice Gonzalez wants it known that he's here in spirit to participate in the deliberation and decision of this case. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Trinity Universal versus Fleeker.
Mr. Roger Townsend, we present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I agree with what the respondents told the Court of Appeals. This is not a Stowers case. It's not a Stowers case because the purpose of the Stowers doctrine is to protect the insured. The purpose is not to compensate the injured parties. Their being compensated is an incidental result of the Stowers doctrine, but that is not its purpose. In this case, the plaintiffs obtained a turnover order, even though Bleeker himself had no complaints about Trinity's handling of the claims. The turnover order and the subsequent litigation was designed solely to obtain compensation for the injured parties. It had nothing to do with protecting Bleeker. Therefore, the Stowers doctrine should not apply. I'd like you to first consider the only written demand that was ever made in this case. We attached it to our application for writ of error at tab E, plaintiff's exhibit 3, the April letter from Villegas. You will see in that letter that there is no express offer of a release at all. You will see that the word settle is not even used. And one of the witnesses at trial said that's almost conspicuous by its omission. Most important, you will see that the letter is very careful to say what will happen if Trinity does not honor the demand. But it nowhere says what will happen if Trinity does honor the demand and pay the money into the registry of the court.
Counting the statute, the hospital lien statute says any settlement that does not take into account the hospital lien is invalid.
That's correct.
Okay. On the issue of the DTPA, the unconscionability, why is that not a viable cause of action?
We have three responses to the unconscionability argument, Your Honor. First of all, this court's decision in American Physicians versus Garcia said that the DTPA does not apply to the handling of third-party claims, which is what this is. All the prior decisions involve first-party lawsuits.
It basically just says that, but is there, I mean, a lot of states either have like a negligence claim or some have under some sort of consumer protection or deceptive trade claim that exists out there, but why can't those exist simultaneously? What is it that says it just doesn't exist?
Other than this court's authority in American Physicians, it goes in Allstate versus Watson, where it goes to great lengths to talk about the interplay of the insurance code and the DTPA. I cannot quote you a detailed policy response as to why it should not apply, other than there are very different considerations at play when you're dealing with a first-party case and you're dealing with a third-party case. One of the issues being, which is my second response on unconscionability, that you measure unconscionability at the time of the transaction, which is when the insurance policy is purchased. This court has held that in the Nicolau case and also Parkway versus Woodruff. At the time the policy was purchased, there is no gross disparity in value or the other indicia of unconscionability that this court has required. The third argument we have on unconscionability is simply there is no evidence of causation. The Court of Appeals itself rejected all of the DTPA claims on the grounds that there was no evidence that they had caused Bleeker any damages. But then at the tail end of its opinion, when it's thinking of the unconscionability claim, which was the other side's cross-appeal, they just say it should have been submitted with no discussion of the causation problem whatsoever. All the arguments that apply to show there's no causation from any DTPA violation also apply to the unconscionability claim.
Ultimately, if there was not a settlement that required the insurance company to respond, then Bleeker was subject to an excess judgment anyway.
Correct.
And that's the argument, that there'd be no causation.
That's exactly the argument. And I think, Your Honor, that is why he was always satisfied with our handling of his claim, because he realized we had not caused him any damages, he was not going to suffer any.
If the facts of the case had been that Bleeker would have accepted a settlement in excess of the policy limits, would that change the outcome and the unconscionability on the causation issue?
In some circumstances, yes. In the facts of this case, I don't think it would matter there, because if you assume that a settlement offer was even made, the settlement offer was only on behalf of the Villarreals. It did not include the Ochoas. It did not include the hospitals. So Bleeker still would have had an excess judgment of more than $7 million against him, even if he had told us to pay the Villarreal claim. Without proof that he is more harmed by a $7 million excess judgment than a $12 million excess judgment, I don't think he would have a claim under the facts of our case. Different situation, it's possible that they could show causation.
We could reach the decision in this case without reaching whether or not unconscionability exists as a matter of law.
Very easily, Your Honor, because the demand in this case, such as it was, did not offer a release, did not use the word even settle to resolve the litigation, then no Stowers duty was invoked whatsoever by this court's precedence. To get around that, the plaintiffs then came in with testimony from Mr. Villegas that he orally offered a release. But his testimony is deficient for several different reasons. The first one being, as I just said, he represented only the Villarreals. By his own admission, he did not make any demand on behalf of the Ochoas, couldn't make a demand for them because he didn't represent them. And he couldn't represent them at that time because of a conflict of interest. He admits that. Also, he hadn't talked to the hospital, so there's no indication that the hospitals were going to waive their lien. And in fact, 2 years later, they still wanted the entire policy limits for their lien. Second problem with the oral testimony comes from the fact that it had to have conditions for the alleged demand. This court just last month, in unanimous opinion, State Farm versus Maldonado, reiterated that a Stowers demand has to be unconditional. This demand by Villegas, if you even believe it was made, had two conditions that had to be in it. One is that it would have to be approved by or recommended by attorneys ad litem and approved by the court, because there were several minors involved. And both Villegas at trial and the trial judge himself admitted that this case cannot be settled without the ad litems concurring in it. So that's one condition. Second condition being that the hospitals were going to have to go away.
Is it your position that no insurance company could be Stowers if there are minor children involved?
I think the way it can be done, Your Honor, is simply to have a hearing in front of the trial court with the ad litems and have, you know, just talk it through on the record that I, the plaintiff's lawyer, believe that it's in the best interest to settle for the policy limits, have the ad litems testify, or just state on the record that we've reviewed matters, discussed it with the injured parties, and we believe there are no more assets, so we believe that a settlement of the policy limits is appropriate. And the court can say, if such a settlement, you know, is forthcoming, I will approve the settlement. At that point, you can easily Stowerize an insurance company. All right, the other condition is that the hospitals were going to have to go away, because as you noted, Judge, the statute says they get priority and any release is invalid unless they agree to it, in effect, or been paid. The illogic of the respondent's position is so extreme that they've come into this court in their briefing and said, we were going to give Bleeker a release even though all of the money was going to go to the hospital. We just wanted you to pay the money into the registry of the court. We know that the hospital is going to take the $40,000, but out of the goodness of our hearts, we were going to sign a release for Bleeker anyway.
What's wrong with paying all the money in the registry of the court?
The problem is,
from the moment this happened, that you first heard of this accident, that your money was gone.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's the irony of this case. The irony is we're being punished for placing Bleeker's interests above our own. We were trying to get a release from everybody, which was in his best interest. He said,
but how long did you get to do that? 6 years, 5 years?
No, I think when there's a steady record showing that we are continually trying to address this issue. It's certainly a different case from an insurance company that would write a letter and say, don't talk to us, we're not going to do it. The record here indicates for more than a year, a steady stream of correspondence from us to the other side saying, get everybody in the court, tell us how to apportion this. Villegas himself wrote not only the clients, but the ad litems over a year after he claimed the negotiations were over. We have correspondence from him saying, the insurance company is still offering $40,000. Please tell me how y'all think it should be apportioned. And those are facts that have led us to argue that you ought to require a written demand. Because when there are three big reasons for this. One is, anytime you're in a salvage case, you're going to be dealing with things that occurred many, many years before, because there's going to be the underlying lawsuit, and then there's going to be the salvage lawsuit. So even if everybody's on the up and up, memories are going to fade. That's just a fact of life. You're also going to have confusion about the terms. I mean, was a release for everybody offered, or was it just for some people, those things? If it's in writing, you can tell from the four corners. The fact of whether a demand is made to invoke the Stowers duty becomes a question of law. The jury can fight over whether it was reasonable or not to honor, but you don't have to have a fight about whether the demand or the duty was ever invoked.
In this instance, your client was absolutely judgmental.
That's
better, clear from the record.
Well, actually, there's evidence in the record that people were trying to investigate to determine the extent of his assets, and that was one part of the delay.
I can see if a client has some possibility of future assets, why you would very much want your insurance company to work as hard as possible to structure some negotiation that would minimize your exposure. But had you paid this money into the registry of the court within the 25 days or 20, whatever it was, that at least now the testimony is there was an offer and that was open, there would have been no further, in all likelihood, no further action against your client.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true, Your Honor. At giving the testimony its best reading for the other side, the four or five Villarreals would have gone away. But there were two other Villarreals, there were all the Ochoas, and there were the hospitals. The Ochoas, who never made a demand, were found by the jury to have over $7 million in damages.
But I mean, they would have been facing absolute judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor. But here's the rule that the plaintiffs want you to adopt. They want you to say an insurance company has to give the money to the first person to make a demand. As long as the first demand could conceivably go for policy limits, then the first one to make a demand gets everything. They're explicit about that.
They also say you could discharge by putting it in registry.
For those people.
I thought it was for all kinds, for anybody else to intervene.
No.
Hospitals, Ochoas.
At the time that was done, the Ochoas hadn't even filed suit yet. They were hanging out there. The only suit on file was by the Villarreals. And in fact, I don't believe there had even been service process at that time.
If there's a question of liability, if the Stowers duty is a duty to settle, to not be negligent when failing to settle within policy limits, is the Stowers duty discharged by an insurance company faced with a demand paying money in the registry of the court?
See, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think this is the catch-22 that they were working on the Soriana. I think they wanted us to pay the money into the registry for the Villarreals. Maybe the Villarreals were going to give a release. That's what they say at trial. But maybe the hospital was going to take the money and the Villarreals were still going to pursue us. But leaving that aside, the Ochoas then are clearly free under Soriano to come in and go after Bleeker, get their judgment, and then take an assignment or a turnover and say that we were negligent under Stowers for giving the money where the Villarreals could get it. Soriano says that you have the right to settle with first come if it's a reasonable settlement, but it does not eliminate the possibility that the second come is going to challenge that settlement. And I think under the circumstances of this case and the venue we were in, we would be right back here with maybe a $7.5 million claim against Trinity rather than $12 million, but we'd be in the same boat. Let me make one other point, too, to stress to you the irony of this case. Under our insurance policy, if I may continue for just 1 minute, we had the right to end the defense when we tendered limits. The policy's clear. When we pay the limits, the duty to defend expires. We could have said to Bleeker, we're paying the money into the court, you know, we're out of here, good luck defending those other claims by the Ochoa's pro se, but that's life. But we didn't do that. We stayed in the case. We tried to negotiate. We tried to get him a release from everybody, which is what not only he wanted, but Villegas himself said was in his best interest. And we shouldn't be punished for that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chairman. The court is ready to hear arguments in response.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Watkins will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. We're here on a case which, again, I suggest, attempts to move the fulcrum between the balance of power between an insurance company and its insured. And we're having a hard time trying to find where that fulcrum ought to be. It slides back and forth, and it has for the last 20 years, 30 years that I know about, as to what is the balance of power between an insurance company and its insured as to who's going to control, manage, and take care of the litigation. This is a first-party claim. There's no doubt about that. They can say that the first-party claim relates to how they deal with the third party, but this is a first-party claim, a claim which has been taken over by a creditor. But that doesn't change the nature of the cause of action. The real question here is what is the power of an insurer to protect themselves against its insurance company if, in fact, the insurance company is negligent and fails to settle within a proper demand? And I suggest to you that that fulcrum should not be moved, that it ought to stay right where it is right now, and that the insurance company doesn't need any more protection, and that the insured does need more protection. Now, some of you know I represent insureds sometimes who are Fortune 500 insureds who have a hard time getting along with their insurance company and trying to get them to settle within policy limits. It is not always the insolvent who happened to be in this situation. Now, bad facts make for bad law, and these folks getting killed and maimed in bad facts, and plaintiff's lawyers representing them in the trial court have a duty to try to collect from wherever they can. And we can't fault them for that, and that's not one of the issues here in this case. The turnover is a final judgment which cannot be collaterally attacked here. And they think that because Mr. Bleeker testified, as I've got up there on the board, that that cause of action didn't exist, that should have arisen in the turnover case, just like it did in the Tennis case, which is relied upon by the other side.
If you have a hospital lien statute that says that any settlement that does not satisfy the hospital is invalid, then how do you have a demand within policy limits that settles the case?
Because I cannot understand how a recorded lien can have anything to do with the policy limits. In other words, it's not valid. The settlement is not valid as far as the hospital company is concerned, but the settlement offer from my client is certainly is valid. That statute has to apply to whether or not the insurance company has the power to divest the hospitals of that money. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not I can enter into an agreement with the insured and say to him, I'm going to release my claim if you'll pay the money into the registry of the court. Now, does that in any way put the company in jeopardy? It does not.
What was the motivation for your client to do that?
Because this lawsuit needed to be over.
But they wouldn't get any money for the release.
Oh, we don't know that. The testimony is that you put the $40,000 into the registry of the court, there's going to be a fight between all the claimants, including the hospitals, and a negotiation could have very likely have taken place, which would not have subjected Mr. Bleeker to any excess judgment.
How much would the hospital do?
How much would the hospital what?
Bill.
Well, the hospital bills are way past.
The hospital bills are way past that.
The
limits are just $40,000.
Right.
Could the hospital make a claim, subrogation, against the insurance company for those funds directly?
Not if the money is paid into the registry of the court. The hospital is fully protected. The money's there. They've got all their liens.
But the hospital still has to litigate over
their entitlement to the funds.
That's correct.
So they haven't resolved their dispute.
That's correct.
And the insurance company's obligation is to pay the funds on behalf of the insurer to the extent that they can settle this case.
Sure. I mean, they can pay that into the registry of the court and settle my case, get rid of $4.5 million worth of liability for their insurer by paying that $40,000 in, interplead the hospital, interplead the other claimants, and they're free. They walk away.
Does the hospital have a cause of action to the extent of all the hospital bills that were incurred on behalf of the Villarreal?
I believe so.
So the insurance company could not have settled the hospital's claim against Bleeker by paying the money in the registry of the court. They could only have settled the Villegas claim on that.
That's right. But they would have protected themselves from the hospital.
But irrespective of protecting themselves, Tower's duty is to protect their insurer.
That's
and not be negligent in if they fail to settle.
That's right.
So in your view, they have satisfied their obligation to their insurer to not be negligent in the settlement. If the moment the first demand comes in, it will settle the one claimant, they must pay the funds there to not be negligent, failing to settle. If they fail to pay those funds, then I guess where I'm concerned, don't we have to evaluate whether or not there's an opportunity to settle all of the hospital's claims and all of the Villegas claims? And unless that can't occur, the mere fact that it might be, should have settled earlier as opposed to later, I guess what I'm trying to say is, Villegas say you should have paid the money to us immediately. The insurance company says, now, wait a minute. We could satisfy it by having paid it, but our obligation to our insured is to try and settle all the claims, not just some of them. And so we don't want to pay this in the registry of the court based on this one. We want to hold back and see if we can work out a better deal.
Right.
Now, how is that a breach of the Stowers' duty?
Because the plaintiff gets to go to the jury and say, was that a stupid thing to do? What the petitioner, in this case, wants to say is they don't ever want to go to a jury. And goodness knows, having been in Hidalgo County, I understand sometimes you don't want to go to a jury. But that's our system. The question is, who determines whether or not they were reasonable? Do we say there's no issue, no fact? And what this case is about is safe harbors for the insurance company to not have to write a check. And every time we put another limit on the Stowers doctrine, we move the power to the company to sit back on the money and not write it.
Well, we do what you say. The incentive is going to be to dump the insured, isn't it? It's going to be to pay the $40,000 and walk away. Isn't that going to be the practical effect?
In Soriano, this court said, we conclude that when faced with a settlement demand arising out of multiple claims, inadequate proceeds, that's our case, an insurer may enter into a reasonable settlement with one of the several claimants, even though such settlement exhausts or diminishes the proceeds available. So they already have the right from this court to dump the insurer.
So they should have.
This says may. Doesn't say they have to. It says may. I presume if it says may, it also means they may not.
But should they?
Now wait. If it's may or may not, who's going to decide that? Is it going to be the jury, or are we going to set a rule of law that says they don't have to, they're safe either way they go? If we go with the petitioner in this case, that may right there is solely up to them. They can wait as long to write the check whenever they want to. They have no power on their insured to tell them, I want this case settled.
I see a more narrow question, though, Mr. Watkins. The question I see is, can a plaintiff, Stowers, an insurance company, by merely saying, insurance company, I don't want you holding the money, I want somebody else to hold the money, can I come forward and say, my complaint against you is not that you didn't pay me the money, it's just that rather than paying in the registry of the court, you held the money.
I plaintiff can say to the insurance company, I want to Stowerize you, and you can comply with my request that I'm attempting to Stowerize you with by paying the money into the registry of the court. It's a valid request. It's a valid offer of settlement. It gives to the company the opportunity to get rid of $4.5 million in this case worth of liability by paying the money into the registry of the court.
And dump its claim. Without getting a release, without even trying it.
Well, they're getting a release for $4.5 million.
There was not even a release for that. They were just paying into the registry of the court.
Well, then that's the question, whether or not you say that the Stowers letter has to have magic words.
Well,
let's assume that it did.
I want to answer that question.
Well, don't tell.
Oh, okay. Peter, go ahead.
Well, I assume that they were going to get a release. You're going to be Leakers, $4.5 million to the duck here. But is he really better served by having unlimited hospital demand and more Villarreal than all Ochoa's out there with unsatisfied claims?
In this case,
the insurance company, regardless of Mr. Townsend's fear, pretty well protected by the Soriano.
Is he better served is the question for the jury. And in this case, the evidence is conclusive he is better served. I mean, we can't say, well, we don't have the right here to decide, wonder what I would have done if I'd been on that jury. And the question was, were they negligent and was that a proximate cause? And that assumes all the questions that both justices have just asked me about what happens when the payment of the money. The only evidence in this case.
Well, I mean, you're always better served if you can buy $40,000 worth of insurance and figure out a way to get $10 or $20 million worth of protection out of it. But assuming that...
What I'm saying is that the $40,000 is a target, clearly. And the question is, where do the insurance companies put the target? Do they put it right on the back of Mr. Leaker? Or by writing the check, do they move the target over the courthouse where the $40,000 becomes the target and Mr. Bleeker doesn't become the target?
He's absolutely judgment-proof. That's pretty good. But what if you're somebody that actually has a little extra money? You have a college savings account or a small business or something.
I would certainly think that you
wouldn't you want your company to try to do their best to get some more than one release?
And that was the issue in front of the jury, Judge. I mean, the question is, was it negligence? And the jury decided it was. And the question for the court, is there any evidence that it was negligence? And there is evidence it was negligence.
What is it? How can it possibly be negligent to try to get your insured off the hook?
I can have good motives and commit negligence all the time. And in this case, by not paying the $40,000, they kept alive $4.5 million worth of liability.
But even if they paid it, there was still
there was $7 million.
$7 million out there.
But you just dumped him in the grease pool.
Well, but this court's already said they can do that. If you say they can, then that means they also cannot. And somebody has to test whether or not it's negligence to either do it or not do it. And
so
that's the jury's job.
So actually, Mr. Townsend is exactly correct. Whether they paid it or whether they didn't pay it, somebody would be in here arguing one side or the other of Soriano saying, well, they shouldn't have in this case. They could have. Soriano gives them the right. But they shouldn't have in this case $80 million, or they should have in this case $80 million. But however it comes out, it still comes out to $80
million. No. Serrano says if they make a decision that the amount of money compared to the liability of the one claim that they've got, they as a matter of law cannot be negligent by making that payment. In this case, they could have gotten rid of $4.5 million worth of liability by a $40,000 payment. They're absolutely protected by Soriano.
Would you say you're here arguing to protect the insurers? You know, I mean, not just Mr. Bleeker. You're here for the policyholders of Texas.
That's correct.
But what it seems to me it gets down to is the way you protect the policyholders of Texas is by making sure that they have free assignment of claims against their own company, regardless of what course of action the insurance company takes.
Well,
I mean, I don't understand any less. I don't understand any other protection you're offering. You say the jury is the ultimate protection, but you're not offering to us any way to structure conduct by which the insurance company behaves in a way that maximizes, short of litigation, the way the insurance company behaves that can maximize its discharge of its duties to its insurer.
I'm asking you not to give the insurance company any more protection than you give me when I practice law, in which I'm going to have to go to a jury to test whether or not I did it right or not. Or give me when I drive home from this courthouse in my automobile, in which I'm going to have to go to a jury to determine whether or not I drove the car right or not. There is no reason to say to the insurance company, once we've given them that choice to say you can either settle with the first one or not settle with the first one, we need to have somebody to say they did it wrong if they do it wrong.
And
under our system, that's the jury.
No guidance short of an individual case. No guidance to say, if you have claims that are clearly in excess, multiple claims clearly in excess of the policy limits, you have 6 months to try to work something out, and then you put it into the registry. No further guidance like that.
I think that's a legislative question for the legislature to
So not a question of ordinary care. That always goes to a jury.
I think that's the system. And I suggest it's not a bad system in this case. I think it's absolutely logical to go into court and say, you could have put the $40,000 in there. Would that have protected the insurer? That's the proximate cause issue. And was it negligent not to? That's the negligence issue in that issue. And then somebody's going to have to answer that question.
So you're telling me if the insurer has come into your law office and the money's gone, you're going to tell them the insurance company did exactly the right thing, paying it all to those other folks?
I'm going to read that quote out of Serrano, and I'm going to say, was it negligent to pay the $40,000 when they got rid of $4.5 million worth of the outstanding claim?
Why wouldn't you proceed to get a judgment against Bleeker and then get an assignment from Bleeker of his claims against the insurance company?
Because
you were negligent for settling with the Villarreal and not the Ochoa.
Because this court has already said that cause of action does not exist.
The truth of the matter is, if there is responsibility of the insurance company to always go to the jury if they don't pay the first claim, Soriano doesn't become a may, Soriano becomes a shall. The insurance company shall pay the first claim, that's first demand that's made in multiple demand claims that exceed the policy limits, because the only protection we know from Soriano, the insurance company can't be liable for having paid on the first claim.
If it's reasonable.
If it's a reasonable claim and it takes up. But we do know that is a question of fact if they failed to pay that first claim. It's a question of fact as to whether or not paying that claim was negligence. So an insurance company, the only thing they do know in a multiple claim circumstance where any of the claims exceed the policy limits is they must pay the first one that gets there. Even if the demand is not to pay the individual making the demand, but the demand is I want you to pay Bill, or I want you to pay John, or I want you to pay the court. I don't care whether you pay me or not, but I just don't want you to have the money. They must pay that first one.
They must act reasonably when that demand comes in, and that doesn't change.
Well, to avoid having six people decide whether or not they did it not negligently, they've got to pay the first one.
That's what Stowers said. Stowers says that duty exists, and what the petitioners in this case are trying to carve out additional safe harbors where the company doesn't have to write the check.
Could you discuss the DCPA claim and what is in the record to support the DCPA claim?
The question about unconscionability has to do with the issue of the fact that the insurance company never told either their insured to give him the option of whether or not he wanted to settle. Let me be real clear about that. In the handout I gave you to this board, and this is everything I can find about what Mr. Bleeker, the insurer, had to say about the settlement, and I defy you to find any set of conduct on the part of the insurance company that the answer to these questions would not have been the same. In other words, no matter what the insurance company had done, the answer to each of these questions is still the same. Would you want the release from everybody if you could get it? That could always be yes. It's never going to be no. Did you understand you'd be liable? Yes. So you agree that you want a release from all the injured persons in return for your policy limits, correct? That would be best? Yes. Well, then you would desire for there to be a release from all the injured parties. The answer to that is yes. I can't imagine any fact situation in which the defendant doesn't say, I want a release from everybody if you can get it. There's absolutely nothing in there that indicates, by the way, if we had told you about it. Now, see, that's offensive. They didn't even tell the insured about the settlement offer. They didn't tell the insured's lawyer about the settlement offer. During the window of time when this $4.5 million worth of claims could have been settled by sending $40,000 over to the registry of the court, they told neither their insured to give him the option, nor did they tell the insurance lawyer that they had hired to represent him about the settlement offer. That's evidence of negligence. That's evidence of unconscionability. That's evidence of a violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act.
Mr. Watkins, Mr. Townsend tells us that the DCPA deals with consumer transactions and that you've got to have a transaction at issue in order for an unconscionability claim to arise, and that the transaction in this case occurred when Mr. Bleeker purchased his insurance. This all happened after the fact, after the actual transaction, the purchase of the insurance, had occurred. She says makes the unconscionability claim not viable as a matter of law. Would you respond to that?
Yes, I think that the law is that clear about laundry list violations, that the violation of a specific list in the laundry list has to be occurred at the time that the transaction is entered into. I'm not sure the law is that clear, nor should it be, that the unconscionability relating to that section of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act relates only to misrepresentations or things that occurred at the time of the inception
of the
contract.
Well, but if the unconscionability claim is designed to look at situations where there is unequal bargaining power, a great disparity in the bargaining power, doesn't that imply that some sort of consumer transaction must occur in connection with the conduct that's being complained about?
That's correct.
And this transaction had already concluded. We don't have any bargaining going on here. We don't have money changing hands. We don't have the purchase of goods or services at this point in time.
Well, we have the delivery of an insurance policy by a consumer who's buying an insurance policy.
And that occurred all before this conduct occurred.
And if we're going to say that the unconscionability section relates to only those things that the laundry list relates to and adds nothing to them, then I think you're absolutely right. I suggest that's bad policy.
All right. Well, what would be the basis? How could the DTPA be interpreted to apply in a circumstance like this, taking into account the language in the statute that defines what an unconscionability claim is?
I would suggest that unconscionability has to do with by measuring what's delivered versus what was paid for it.
How much did he get in legal services? How much did Blinker receive in legal services under his insurance policy?
I don't know the answer to that question, but for our purposes, let's assume a whole lot, because they did hire a lawyer and he defended him and they did a whole lot of work. So I think there's good value. I'd have to give that up, but there's good value in the defense of the case for Mr. Bleeker in this case. There's no complaint about the attorney trying the case that they didn't do a good job on that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
On the DTPA claim, I would like to point out that it's their burden of proof, and the evidence in the record is that Bleeker's own personal lawyer, who was advising him at this time, when he heard about the demands later, said, I would not have wanted the insurance company to accept those demands because it didn't give Bleeker a complete release. So if there's any evidence in the case on this issue at all, it would be that Bleeker would not have suffered any damages by our not telling him about the so-called demand. I think also there's been a kind of a premise missed in the respondent's argument here. The whole argument's premised on the idea there really was a settlement demand ever made, and we dispute that not just because of some of the incredibility of the Yegas testimony, but the letter itself, which doesn't say that, but the statute, 55.007 of the Property Code. It's very clear a release of a cause of action is not valid unless the hospital is paid in full before the release is signed or the hospital is a party. I mean, Villegas could not have offered a valid release without having the hospital somehow on board, and he admitted he had not talked to the hospital and did not talk to them until after that window had expired. I think y'all understand this from your questions, but let me just give you a hypo on the Soriano issue. And let me also say first, too, when all this was going on in our case, Soriano was not on the books yet. It happened later. So we were in the dark as all this is going on. But anyway, think about the example of a car wreck and somebody's got a broken leg and there's a brain-damaged baby. With today's jury verdicts, broken leg is obviously going to be worth $40,000. And they race in and they make the demand. Are we supposed to pay the $40,000 for broken leg and then tell the insured, you've got this brain-damaged baby problem out there, you know, good luck. Defend it pro se, and, you know, the rest of your life you've got that $20, $30 million judgment against you. Or do we at least have the right to try to see if we can wrap everything up into a package?
But shouldn't that, if you were to have such a duty, you can't just be your right is to wait around until the case gets tried. See how you do.
That's correct. And that's and
you would have to be very proactive. And how would such a duty be shaped? Wouldn't that also buy you a jury trial?
Well, I don't think it should buy you a jury trial when you have the facts of our case, where the evidence is clear, month after month after month, that we're corresponding with the other side, saying here are our limits. Tell us. You know, when you've got everybody in the court, here they are, we're ready to pay, please come get them, and they won't do it. And that's the other fallacy of this whole argument, that somehow this was a bona fide release. Well, why is the window of time so short? I mean, why is it 1 month to honor this demand that the hospital is going to get the money anyway. It's obviously designed solely to set up the insurance company in this case.
If you had a single plaintiff who offered to settle for policy limits and the letter said, we will release our claims if you deposit money into the registry of the court, would that be a valid claim?
If there's no hospital liens, or the hospital liens are you know, taken care of, yes, Your Honor, it would.
Well, I'm just saying their offer is to give you a release in return for your depositing money in the registry of the court.
With a single claim, yes.
With hospital liens up to the amount of your coverage, but not over.
Right, right. Because otherwise, the release is invalid by statute. They can't give you what they're offering you. And that's the one thing this court has always been adamant about on the Stowers duty, is you have to offer a release that will end the litigation. And I'm not asking for magic words. I mean, that's why I pointed out, he didn't even say settled. You know, settled would probably imply release. Be careful not to use that.
Any other questions? That concludes the argument in both of today's causes. These causes are submitted. I'll read some oral arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.